It's not always easy to find the positive. You might even need to search for happiness. Sometimes, just a little inspiration can make the difference. Here, it comes from unexpected places. Welcome to the Tangential Inspiration Podcast.
Hi, I'm Teresa.
And I'm Amy.
We are two ordinary moms
looking for inspiration wherever we can find it.
So, Teresa, what was your highlight from last week?
I wanted to talk about the food drive.
Oh,
because yeah. I think that was just a blast for a number of reasons. I love that, well, to get to spend the time with you.
Oh, yeah.
I did let my kids sleep in because I was worried if no one showed up, then they might be a little bit grouchy and you'd hear them, you know, grumbling a little bit. So I just love that as we're sitting there discussing how to make the next one better.
Right, yeah.
Up drives my mom's friend and Bible study leader,
Judy,
with, you know, a ton of food. And she had taken her grandchildren around and collected money in their neighborhood. So we got a money donation for the neighborhood house and food. And then I loved that one man who probably, he appeared to possibly be homeless, but brought us food and said that everybody needs help sometimes. So I just left there totally inspired.
Me too. That's
with the
I
people
felt.
That were bringing food. And then to have my girlfriend Diane and her partner Nancy drop it off for us and then send me a picture that it was being sent and taken by good hands just warmed my heart.
Yeah, all me feels. Too.
I loved Judy had commented on Mother Teresa and loneliness. Oh, yeah. And I knew, you know, I know quite a few Mother Teresa quotes, mainly because she shares my name, or I guess I share her name. But I had to look up the one on loneliness because I wasn't familiar with it. But she said, "We can cure physical diseases with medicine, but the only cure for loneliness, despair, and hopelessness is love."
Oh.
And I just love all of that because I think she was wise beyond her years. I am most definitely a coffee drinker.
Oh, me too.
It's like gotten into the habit where it's the first thing that I want in the morning. My husband's hooked up the coffee pot to our Google Home system, so I can wake up and tell, you know, Google to turn on the coffee pot, and then I've got an extra 5 minutes, and then I can get up and enjoy my coffee. But I also love the occasional Starbucks soy vanilla latte.
Oh, yeah.
But I hate having to go there, wait in line, so I mostly stick to my own home brewed coffee. However, with this find, I would probably be getting more coffee at Biddy and Bo's coffee shop if we had one nearby.
Oh.
So Biddy and Bo's was started in Wilmington, North Carolina in January 2016. Amy Wright opened the shop named after her two youngest children, Biddy and Bo.
Oh.
Amy and her husband Ben opened the shop when they started to think of the future of Biddy and Bo, who both have Down syndrome. They thought about how difficult it is for people with intellectual impairment to find work and feel like they're contributing to their community. Before starting this company, Amy and Ben Wright had discovered that 70% of adults with intellectual or developmental disabilities are unemployed.
Oh,
that's just crazy.
It is crazy. I there's an article I saw about hearing impaired also have high unemployment.
It's just unfair.
Yeah.
Amy and Ben wanted better for Biddy and Bo. They wanted to change things by creating a company that would generate jobs and opportunities for the disabled. They researched different businesses and landed on a coffee shop, which I think is brilliant.
Yeah.
So they started a coffee shop, only about 500 square feet, and hired the majority of their staff from the developmentally disabled community. Originally named just Bo's Coffee, the name was changed to Biddy and Bo's when Bo asked for Biddy's name to be added on his 12th birthday.
Oh, cute.
How sweet is that?
Yeah.
The first store started with 19 employees that were developmentally disabled. The coffee shop became such a local hit with lines out the door. They eventually moved into a 5,000 square foot space that allowed people to stay and enjoy their coffee and become the company's national headquarters. The reception from the community has been great and the business has been booming for the company. In 2018, they opened their second store in Charleston, South Carolina. Annapolis, Maryland, Savannah, Georgia soon followed. The company is also partnering. Growing, definitely.
Yeah.
The company is also partnering up with large corporations to put their coffee shops in the national headquarters of the companies. In all the stores, an average of 80% of the employees are developmentally disabled. Several of the managers for the stores are former social workers with experience working with intellectually challenged people, which I think is brilliant.
You know, and the community for those individuals. I think that's so awesome.
The employees also receive minimum wage plus tips. Federal law allows companies to hire developmentally disabled people under sheltered workplace laws and pay them less than minimum wage.
Aww.
Which is hard enough with minimum wage, let alone less than.
Yeah.
The Wrights chose not to do this, wanting to create a place where their employees can help support themselves and get real world work experience. Biddy and Bose is a nonprofit, and all the proceeds go to Able to Work USA, which is a nonprofit that pairs developmentally disabled workers with businesses across the country. The employees have conditions ranging from cerebral palsy to Down syndrome. The jobs give them confidence and allows them to contribute to society. They provide a needed service and get to help others. So it's a win-win.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Wright says, we always say it's more than a cup of coffee. It's a human's right movement. And the coffee shop's just a vehicle for making that happen. It's given our employees the respect they deserve. People have come from all over the world for coffee, and the main store keeps a map with pins to mark where the people have come from.
Oh,
just like that. Just like our map for the podcast.
Yay.
Another part of the coffee shop that I just love is that it helps break down barriers. People coming into Biddy and Bo's get to interact with employees who have a disability and find that they are not all that different. Once you start interacting with people with disabilities, a lot of the stigmas start to disappear.
That's so true.
In an interview with CNN, Amy Wright said, creating this has given people a way to interact with people with disabilities that they never would have had before. She said, this is a safe place where people can test the waters and realize how much more alike we are than different. And that's what it's all about. I just love this. I hope they branch out this way, and I really hope other companies will find ways to employ more physically and disabled people. It just makes a huge difference in their lives and really helps break down the barriers.
Yeah.
So it's a win for all of us.
Yeah.
Me too. I want to just circle back before I cover Irina Sendler way back to episode one.
Oh, wow.
With Claudette Colvin, the young lady who refused to give up her seat on the bus well before Rosa Parks.
Right.
I had noted an author that I found while researching her, Philip Hoos. He wrote a great book on children's history, complete with pictures, which is a big thing for me. I like photos.
Well, tells a story.
Well, yeah. But this one, that's a different one. But
yeah.
The book that I wanted to just quickly cover is The Boys Who Challenged Hitler, Knud Peterson and the Churchill Club.
Wow, that's a heavy title.
It's a heavy title. It's a super quick read, and I loved it for a number of reasons. The young men in the story, and I mean young, decide to take action when the adults around them aren't doing anything, when they think that they aren't doing enough to protect their country. Denmark had been taken over by the German army, and the boys thought their country didn't do enough to resist. And apparently Winston Churchill agreed because he was calling Denmark, quote, Hitler's tame canary.
Oh.
So the boys, they organized and strategically sabotaged German vehicles, power lines, buildings that had ammunition. I mean, these boys were wanted by the Germans because they were just causing chaos. They were bold enough to sneak into restaurants that the German soldiers frequented, and they'd steal their weapons from the coat room.
So, like, brave.
Really brave. That's incredible. These boys were most definitely not violent, but they wanted to make it as difficult as possible for Hitler's men, and they did just that. I love the story because it's like a David and Goliath tale. These boys were definitely afraid.
Right,
with good reason. Some more than others, but they didn't let that stop them from their mission. There's a page that includes pictures of the Churchill Club, and I found myself constantly going back to the real pictures of the boys and really just how young they were.
Yeah.
And their bravery. You just have to listen to your heart. And these boys did just that, and then they acted. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
If you don't want to know. I especially love the story because they survive.
Oh,
I mean, they definitely had post-traumatic stress disorder and different things.
Of course, but
from this. But I was worried about that since so many resistance fighters didn't survive. But just because they survived doesn't mean they didn't pay a price for their club. The boys were wanted for months and eventually arrested.
Oh.
Where they were given rectal exams upon entry and two sheets of toilet paper.
Oh, my goodness.
I really hope that the sheets meant a different thing back then, because that sounds just absolutely absurd. But they got three slices of rye bread for breakfast, porridge for lunch, and a small portion of something hot for dinner. Knud Peterson, who was interviewed during this whole book.
Yeah.
He lost 44 pounds, he said, in the first month or two. So they did not have food. I just hope that they make a movie of this story because I think it would inspire both young and old to be brave in the face of evil and always listen to your heart. Last week I talked about that Tough Mothers book by Jason Porath. And I just have to cover one more mom from that book. Well, for now that is. I'm sure there will be others. But as I noted last week, this book introduced me to Vera Peters and another number of relatively unknown matriarchs. Ladies who really should be known but still have yet to be discovered. Irina Sendler was on that list. And she's in the book, as not because she was a mother of three, but Jason Porath titled her the mother of the children of the Holocaust. Irina Sendler aided the rescue and relocation of 2,500 Jewish children during dark time in history. I wasn't surprised that I hadn't heard of Irina Sendler. I've remained relatively ignorant with heroes from World War II, well, wars in general, any war for that matter. I've just seen enough photos and I read enough history to know that my heart just can't handle.
It's hard. It's hard to read.
It's just, I can't fathom it. It's just, yeah. For example, Schindler's List. I know it's a brilliant movie.
Yeah.
But I just haven't been able to bring myself to watch it. Just too hard. I know that I'm missing out on a movie and it probably would make me grow, but it's just too much for me. Words I can't convey. They just can't express the evil. And I've just chosen to stay somewhat ignorant, mainly as a way to protect my own heart.
Right. I know. It's so hard to watch.
Yeah. Or to even just know that it happened. But I might break that with a movie out on Irina Sendler, a movie, a woman I think many of us have never heard of. Irina Sendler was born Irina Krasinowska. She was born in Warsaw, Poland on February 15th, 1910. Her father, Stanislaw Krasinowska, was a doctor, and many of his patients were Jewish and poor. At the time, many Polish doctors wouldn't treat Jewish patients because of the propaganda.
That's awful.
Can't even fathom. But the propaganda of the time said that the Jewish people were outsiders and different. But Irina's father didn't share their ideology. He once told Irina, you see a man drowning, you must try to save him, even if you cannot swim.
Oh, wow.
A powerful lesson that clearly made an impression on young Irina. In 1918, the world was dealing with typhus, and Stanislaw got sick. I had to look up typhus because I heard of it. But
I think that's what they used, eventually were using for DDT.
Surprise me. But typhus is, I had to look it up. It isn't spread by human contact like the cold or flu, but by fleas, mites, and lice. It's so disgusting, but it causes fevers, chills, vomiting, nausea, confusion. Modern lifestyles and improvement in our general hygiene have made typhus extremely uncommon. But we also have antibiotics to treat people infected with typhus. So.
Right, so we didn't have that problem.
Unfortunately, not in the time for Irina's dad. He sadly died a few days before Irina's 7th birthday, but the lessons he taught her in his short life were evident throughout hers. Irina would later study to be a social worker, and her education from time spent with her father in their small village would prove to be just as valuable as her formal education, if not more so. Because she was raised to believe we're all the same, she was well-versed in the Jewish culture. She knew their songs, traditions, customs, all because her father had treated Jewish patients.
Right.
So fast forward to September 1st, 1939, when Germans invaded Poland, and they surrendered within several weeks, which kind of reminded me of the Churchill Club.
Right.
I read that by the time Poland surrendered, 40,000 people were dead in Warsaw, and another 70,000 were dead on the battlefield. They simply were outmatched. Jews were rounded up and fenced into less than a 2-mile square area of Warsaw known as the ghetto.
Wow,
Hey guys, it's Joel from Momentous Experience here. How are you going? If you listen to people that I catch up with here and around the world talking about their mental health, the challenges they face, and how they've managed it. It's all about spreading awareness and promoting a peaceful and balanced life. So join me again, Momentous Experience, on Spotify, Apple, and Google.
So with the Nazi invasion of Poland in 1939, they set up an area of the cities to restrict populations they considered undesirable, such as Jews, Romani, which were gypsies at the time. I read anybody with any type of disability, if you were a homosexual is what they called it at the time, they were put into the ghetto and were these small sections of towns and cities that were blocked off from the rest of the city. Jews and Romani were segregated into these small parts of the city. And within weeks, the Nazis invaded Poland. Jews and Romani were uprooted from their homes and jobs and forced into certain areas of the cities or towns. Beginning in 1940, some of the ghettos were literally walled off from the rest of the city by new brick construction or barbed wire, and they were guarded. The Warsaw Ghetto that I'm referring to, one of the largest Nazi-occupied in Europe, was home to 400,000 Jews in an area less than 1.5 square miles.
I'm just trying to imagine this, you know, in my head.
Jews comprised 30% of the Warsaw population, but they were forced to live in a 2.4% area of Warsaw.
Just that's inhumane.
Absolutely. The average occupancy per room in the Warsaw ghetto was 7.2 people per room. In other ghettos, I had no idea these ghettos even existed before Irina, but in other ghettos, there would be room occupancies as high as 12 to 30 people per room. Jews or Romani, if they were found out of the ghetto, they were subject to harsh punishment or even death. Think about just some of the parts of the city being walled off and suddenly being filled with 50 times the normal population in just a few weeks. No access to other parts of the city. While the living conditions varied in ghettos across Europe, conditions were typically brutal. The Nazis were intent on eradicating the Jews, and they hoped to do so by slowly starving the Jewish population and letting diseases take the lives of countless others. Since they couldn't leave the ghetto, Jews had to supplement their food rations provided by the Germans by smuggling food in. In 1941, the average ration for a Jew in the Warsaw Ghetto was 184 calories per day. It was mostly dry bread, flour, potatoes.
You can't live off of that.
No! Turnips and grain.
As you were talking about, you're saying this, I'm just imagining how people are thinking during
and
the time.
These are parents in there. You have your children in there with you.
Right.
And that you don't have enough food for yourself or your children. You're living on top of each other. Just it's like you said, inhumane.
Yeah.
I can't even fathom. Once a month, they'd receive some sugar, margarine, and meat. The amounts provided were considered to be starvation diets. They'd eventually lead to illness or death. Children were often used to smuggle food from outside the ghetto, which was extremely dangerous. With the crowded living conditions and lack of sanitation, disease ran rampant. There were few medical supplies and little in the way of qualified care. Tens of thousands of people died in the ghetto just from disease. Dysentery and typhus were very common. They had no firewood to burn and had to burn items found in the ghetto for warmth. In 1942, the Nazis began to move people from the ghetto to concentration camps or simply take them out to the countryside to be shot. Of the 400,000 Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto, approximately 300,000 were deported to concentration camps. There were some attempted uprisings against the Nazis from the ghetto, but they were brutally shut down and almost all of the ghetto population were killed. The German soldiers were extremely worried about typhus, so they had no problem allowing medical personnel into the ghetto if it meant it would lower their risk. So Irina...
Kind of selfish of them. Oh. I mean, golly.
Irina would enter the ghetto as a caseworker, sometimes dressed as a nurse. She'd smuggle in food and other necessities. And keep in mind, the Germans controlled what entered the ghetto, and many Jews simply were, you know, they starved from lack of food. I read that Irina witnessed a young boy begging for food, only to pass by him shortly later. He had already passed away and someone had partially covered his body in newspapers. I think the rest of her life had to live with these images and these sounds and just the nightmare that this was. But the conditions these people endured are inconceivable. Death was everywhere. And yet Irina kept returning to do what she could.
So brave.
Very brave. And I love that one seed that her father planted in her, she just keeps going back to, I can't imagine the picture that, And danger.
Right. And she didn't have to do this. And what is she, like 30 at this point? I mean, if she's going
to... I don't...
1910, I don't know.
Good question. To look into that.
Yeah.
If 30, if that. I don't think she was quite that old yet. But with the help of her underground network, Zagato, the ghetto was roughly the size of Central Park, Central Park.
Okay.
And picture all, you know, 450,000 Jews forced to live in that with high fences and armed guards, making sure that they stayed in that area. So there was this underground network that I said, Zagato. She had a code name, Jolanta.
Wow.
I'm probably mispronouncing that. But she would smuggle food and supplies to the ghetto, which evolved into her smuggling orphans out of the ghetto. Remember, if you're caught aiding a Jew at this time, you were killed. I read a quote from Władysław Bardachowski, a founding member of Zagato. He said, "I hate to say that no work was as dangerous as hiding a Jew. When you're hiding a human being, you have to realize you have a ticking time bomb in your home. If the Nazis find out, they will kill you, your family, and the person you're hiding." That was his quote. It was asking the ultimate sacrifice in order to help a complete stranger. Right. And that's the amazing part. Yeah. These were strangers. They just were called to saving them.
Yeah. It's. I mean, it seems like so long ago in our history, but really.
Not long enough.
You know, and what a horrible, horrific time. I mean.
Irina and 10 heroes working under her were willing to take that risk. And as the Nazis started clearing out the ghetto and deporting their inhabitants to concentration camps, it only escalated the timeline to try to help children escape. Irina and her co-conspirators had several ways that they would get kids out. They used an ambulance. Sometimes a child would be taken out hidden under the stretcher. Some kids just climbed through the sewer and had like secret tunnels underground, which talk about what they must have. It's just scary for a kid and seen under there. Sometimes a trolley would carry out a child hiding in a sack, a trunk, a suitcase, or something similar. I also read that sometimes they didn't use these often, but there would be times where they would use German shepherds and like have them bark so that it would distract.
Okay.
And take, they wouldn't hear the baby crying or the children screaming or whatever, but Irina often had to convince the parents to let her take the children.
They were too afraid, I guess. Or...
And often she'd be asked by the parents if Irina could guarantee their safety, and she had to be truthful and point out that she couldn't guarantee her own safety. She wasn't sure she'd survive leaving the ghetto, but at least if they turned their child over to her, it gave them a little bit of hope that they might survive. There were times the parents asked to think about it, and Irina would return to the ghetto only to find that the family had been deported to a concentration camp. So it was too late. I can't even imagine. The danger didn't end when they escaped the ghetto. There was the constant fear of being discovered. Jewish children were taught Polish songs, Catholic prayers, and were given new names and birth certificates, often of Polish children who had died. So they had records. Irina kept the children's identities on tissue paper hidden in the hopes that one day they would be reunited with their families, which I think is so sweet. Unfortunately, that didn't happen since most of the parents died. She guarded the list with her life and had plans for every scenario to protect the identity of the children and her co-conspirators. Thank goodness she was prepared for all sorts of scenarios, knowing that at any moment she could be taken away by the Gestapo. A fellow Zagato fighter had been arrested and tortured until she revealed Irina's name. And then she was killed. So Irina was arrested and sentenced to death, even though when they went to arrest her, they found no evidence in her home, which I think is pretty amazing. She had she had money hidden from Zagato. You know, they collected money to help free the Jews, but she heard the boots approaching her door, and she quickly gave the list to her friend, and her friend tucked it in her shirt. Later, the friend buried the list to keep the secret. Irina was tortured for months. Both of her legs were broken, as well as her feet. I mean, I read that later in her life, she had to use a cane to walk after this. So this was a lifelong
sacrifice
that she gave. She was taken out for execution, but to her surprise, she was freed. Zagato, that underground group, had bribed the guard for her release. And I thought it was interesting. So she had a code name, and also they named, you know, Zagato was named, but they called it Conrad Zagato because they wanted to trick the German soldiers. So the German soldiers were looking for someone named Conrad Zagato instead of not realizing that that was actually their group.
Oh, clever.
She spent, they were smart and very calculating in everything that they did. But she spent the remainder of the war in hiding once she escaped, just like the children she had saved. She saw a poster even declaring her death, and I just can't imagine keeping that secret. When the war was over, Irina reunited with her friend who had hidden the children's names in a jar buried under a tree in a yard nearby. They turned it into the leader of a Jewish organization trying to find families. Not only did that signify the number of children she saved, but it also gave the kids a piece of their true identity because these had their Jewish names.
Right.
They had been given
they are.
Exactly. Yeah. The renamed children could now try to piece back some of their true identity.
Right.
There's no question this woman was a hero, although before she died, she discussed how much she disliked being called a hero. She didn't like that she was receiving all the accolades from the work her network did. Okay. So
humble.
I know. She was sad that they died before they got the recognition that they so deserved, which I think is sweet. Irina was recognized by VAD Vashem, which is the World Holocaust Remembrance Center. That's a great website to look up. Okay. There are some, as sad as it is, there are some great stories in there of heroes and people trying to, like, one had the history of these earrings that someone had hidden for, you know, because when they were turned over, they had to give them all of their belongings, anything of value. So it's nice that some of these items are being returned to families. People. Or in museums where hopefully we can, something like this will never happen again. But in 1965, she was recognized by VAD Vashem and the Jewish Foundation for Righteous in New York City. But 45 years of communism in Poland buried her story. And that's why we haven't heard of her.
Right.
But it quite possibly might have stayed buried if it wasn't for a teacher.
Oh!
That's the other part of the story from a rural town in Kansas, encouraging his students to participate in a year-long project for National History Day.
Oh.
So Megan Stewart, Elizabeth Cambers, and Sabrina Coons decided to collaborate on a project from an old newspaper clipping they came across about Irina Sendler. When they asked their teacher about this woman, he had no idea who she was, and so he encouraged them to look into it. His class motto, that's so cool. You will love this, he who changes one person changes the entire world.
Oh.
So I love that motto that he spread to his students, but the girls uncovered the story in 1999 and started doing presentations to spread the story of this unknown hero. It was at one of these presentations. They did, like, I want to say 375 by...
Wow.
And in 2001, after a presentation, there was a Jewish businessman asking the girls if they'd be willing to travel to Warsaw to continue putting the pieces of the puzzle together.
Oh, that's really great.
And interview Irina Sendler herself, along with surviving children.
Oh.
So this performance was at a...
I love the closure on that.
I know.
I mean, you know, sad
as it is, but filling in the story.
Right.
I guess, for the victims, but... The performance was at a large school district about 100 miles away from their school. So I just love that it was a seed planted so far away, but this guy, he wanted them to go interview Irina. The performance was in January, and the businessman noted that they'd have to travel that spring since Irina was in poor health. The girls agreed, and he raised the money for the tour and this history project in 24 hours.
Oh.
So it was a go.
And that's before GoFundMe.
I mean, that's incredible. I love that people were willing to help out to get this story out there. In May 2001, Mr. Conrad, that's the teacher, and four students traveled to Poland to meet Irina Sendler. And they interviewed many of the people touched by this woman and her network, including a famous Polish poet who was saved by Irina. And Elzbieta Kowska, a baby that was smuggled out in a carpenter box when she was just 5 months old. Most of the children were not babies that they did. They did rescue some babies, but I read that most of them were not infants. But this high school history project told the world about Irina Sendler, a story that needed to be shared. Well, three girls now are married. They've graduated from college. Megan Stewart Felt is working at the Lowell Milken Center for Unsung Heroes in Fort Scott, Kansas.
Oh.
Another great website to go check out, because this kind of just kind of started this unsung hero concept. But the Lowell Milken Center is an educational foundation developing exciting history projects around the world, things that we haven't heard about, obviously. That's why it's unsung heroes. So to teach respect for all people. Sabrina Coons Murphy and Elizabeth Cambers Hutton are both teachers today, and all three continue to share Irina's story through presentations. One of Amazon's most popular books on the Holocaust is called Life in a Jar, The Irina Sendler Project by Jack Mayer. You can find it on our feature book page on tangentialinspiration.com. I think I'll break down, and I've started talking about this movie, but there was a movie in 2009 that Hallmark made for CBS, and the premiere, it's called The Courageous Heart of Irina Sendler, did have two pretty famous actresses.
Yeah.
The premiere was in Fort Scott, Kansas.
Oh, wow.
Where these girls had lived.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Renata Zaldman, a woman who was rescued by Irina at 14, was in attendance. So I love that the movie, you know, the red carpet was at this, and that was that they had the premiere there. I'm just realizing that sometimes inspiration comes in the ugliest, darkest places. And Irina learned from her father early on how important it is to help others. And because of that, there are 2,500 families that were touched by his sentiment, the sentiment that he instilled in her. I'm grateful to hear of all the resistance fighters doing the right thing, even if it meant losing their lives. It so easily could have ended, closing the book before it was ever written. But thankfully, a few girls from Kansas, inspired by their teacher.
I love that. It's so incredible.
Kept the story very much alive. And I'm certain there are heroes living among us at the very moment, and heroes in the making that
we don't know more stories
to be told.
Yeah.
I also, in looking into this, Gal Gadot is going to be playing Irina Sendler, if it's still, you know, who knows with COVID and all of that.
That's so cool.
But I was reading that her grandpa, Czechoslovakia, was taken over when he was 13.
Oh.
And she has just an amazing, like her family has an amazing story related to World War II and the impact that he had. But how awesome is it that Gal Gadot's going to continue to get
strong?
Oh, I know. Absolutely. So that's another movie that I got to watch when it comes out.
Sunday was Mother's Day, and I came across this story about Vicky Nguyen. She's an investigative journalist for NBC.
Oh.
Of course, she's on the Today Show. But she wrote,
I wasn't even going to ask because I knew.
Okay, she wrote this lovely tribute to her mother. Her mother fled Vietnam to the U.S. with Vicky when she was just 8 months old so she could have a better life. And I just love how Vicky wrote about her mom, so grateful to her that she feels about herself that she doesn't even warrant Mother's Day.
Aww.
I know, but it kind of says a lot. Vicky's parents had moved back to Vietnam, but recently returned to the U.S. to help take care of her three girls that are 12, 9, and 4, because Vicky and her husband have demanding careers with unpredictable hours.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's seven people living in their New York City apartment.
So they moved here for a better life for the daughter.
And then eventually went back. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then they moved back just because, I think, prior to COVID, but just to kind of help with the girls. And she describes her mom leading by example with love, and she's never cross. And she's just constantly in good cheer.
My kids cannot say that.
I think I'm like, I go, wow, I just can't imagine that. She cares for the girls from the start of the day, getting them to school until bedtime. She also shuttles them to after school activities like gymnastics. And she's a fabulous cook. She can whip up spaghetti, chow mein, and Vietnamese crepes. Vicky notes the pandemic has been hard on everyone at home, girls Zooming school, as well as she worked from home. Yet, like many of us, she says it's been a rare time of interrupted togetherness, which we've commented and talked about.
Well, I love that she's putting a positive spin on it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
It's like the lotus blooming in the mud.
Right, right. Her mom is in her 70s, and I just love her mom's joy. She treasures her time with her granddaughters. And I also appreciate Vicky's so appreciative of her mother. And when she's saying, so when Mother's Day comes, I celebrate all that my mom has given to me and all that she continues to provide.
Hmm.
I just love this story about a multi-generation family. Their love, support of each other, especially is sweet, you know, during the crazy times.
Yeah. Very sweet. Real beauty is of the heart. It's the glow that lights your face when you're doing something kind. It's the tears you cry in appreciation of someone else's pain. Real beauty is kindness, gratitude, and love. Roma Downey.
Thanks for listening to Tangential Inspiration. We really want to hear from you. Email us your comments or story suggestions at tangentialinspiration@gmail.com or leave a comment on our website, tangentialinspiration.com.
Our website has all our podcast episodes, show notes, stories, follow-ups, and links to websites and books we talk about. Like and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app, and you can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Have a great week.